Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 5, 2003. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. As a bomb goes off in Indonesia's capital, killing more than a dozen, Australia wants to restart military ties with Indonesia. A campaign begins to extend voting rights to non-US citizens. And Iraqis voice uncertainty about what is being called the puppet administration the US government has set up. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Episcopal Church is about to vote in their first openly gay bishop after the internal investigation cleared him of wrongdoing. Ann Alquist reports from KFAI in Minneapolis.
An Episcopal Church leader says the investigation has concluded. A Vermont man alleged in an email that Gene Robinson inappropriately touched him on several occasions at a church event. The allegations came after the first of two key votes on Sunday that would make Robinson the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church. Those attending the convention supporting Gene Robinson's election suspected the 11th-hour allegations were an attempt to thwart the controversial election. Minnesota gay rights activists say it's significant that the 74th General Convention of the Episcopal Church is meeting in Minneapolis. Minnesota is one of a handful of states that recognizes civil rights for gays, lesbians, transgendered, and bisexual people. In Minneapolis, I'm Ann Alquist.
Today, people around the world are gathering to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the United States' nuclear bombing of Hiroshima. As Miles Ashdown reports from Hiroshima, most who gathered there will work to ensure it never happens again.
The conference brought together people from all over the world: India, Korea, Norway, New Zealand, and 22 other countries. They came together for one reason.
No more Hiroshima! No more Nagasaki, no more Hiroshima, all we want is peace.
Some of the international delegates went to local hospitals and visited survivors of the nuclear attack on Hiroshima. After workshops and special sessions, the delegates drafted a message to the world about the danger of nuclear weapons. Professor Anzai of Japan read the message at the closing session and tells us about a growing threat.
世界20カ国260名の代表が
Even now, some 30,000 nuclear weapons are stockpiled on the planet, and the danger of their use and development is increasing. We call on all of the people of the world to take action together to eliminate the danger of nuclear weapons and achieve a future of hope.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown in Hiroshima, Japan.
The U.S. government's weapons of mass destruction will remain unburned in Anniston, Alabama, as the Army has agreed to a hearing this Friday. More than 2,000 tons of chemical agents being stored in Anniston were scheduled to be incinerated tomorrow. Elizabeth Crow with the Chemical Weapons Working Group describes what happened in court today.
This morning, the judge requested a hearing date for Friday, and the Army rejected it. The judge subsequently called the attorneys from both sides for a hearing at noon today, and only moments into our attorney's argument, a Department of Justice attorney who was representing the Army literally jumped up and said, I have just been authorized to accept Your Honor's original proposal of a Friday hearing date. So with that, the Army has agreed to refrain from any disposal activities until the judge has had a chance to hear the motion and make a decision, which we now expect to be sometime on Friday afternoon.
That was Elizabeth Crow with the Chemical Weapons Working Group. Today, Palestinians and as many as 50 activists were arrested in the occupied West Bank, trying to prevent the Israeli military from continuing their construction of what Israelis are calling a security fence and Palestinians are calling the apartheid wall. On both sides of construction, government officials have canceled another meeting with peace on the agenda. Mohammed Galini reports from Gaza City.
The meeting between Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas and his Israeli counterpart Ariel Sharon on Wednesday has been canceled. Yet both sides gave different reasons for the cancellation. The Israeli government says it was because of the shooting attack by Palestinian militants on Sunday. A Palestinian official stated that the cancellation was due to Israel stalling on the implementation of the roadmap, especially on the issue of prisoner releases. Abbas is expected to meet a delegation from Hamas and Islamic Jihad Tuesday evening to discuss Israeli breaches of the truce. Meanwhile, the Palestinian International Press Center released a report today listing 845 Israeli violations of the unilateral ceasefire since June 30. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mohammed Ghalayini in Gaza.
A 10-day national initiative kicked off today called the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride. Jackson Allers has a story from WBAI in New York.
In addition to the legalization or, quote, road to citizenship for all immigrant workers, attendees emphasized the need for the federal government to protect what they say is the erosion of civil liberties for all immigrants and U.S.-born citizens since September 11th. Democratic Congresswoman from New York, Nidia Velasquez, pointed to the Patriot Act and the Department of Homeland Security as domestic policies that use national security as a guise to crack down on the honest work of legal and illegal immigrants alike.
How can we try to export democracy to Croatia, Bosnia, Sarajevo, and to say that we are fighting for freedom in those countries, even in Iraq, when these type of exploitations and abuses are happening?
All 10 cities participating in the Immigrant Freedom Ride will meet up in Flushing Meadows Park in Queens, New York on October 4th for what ride organizers expect will be a gathering of thousands to drive home the need for immigration reform. I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A car bomb went off today at the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta, Indonesia, during a busy lunchtime hour, killing more than a dozen. While details remain sketchy, Jakarta's government has said the case is, quote, clearly terrorism. And many fear the Indonesian government will use this latest attack to justify further military presence across Indonesia. This is Australia has been negotiating with Indonesia to recommence joint military training exercises. Such a move would mean Australia would be re-engaging with Indonesia's primary so-called counter-terrorism unit, Kopassus, the force considered by international observers as responsible for committing serious human rights abuses in East Timor, West Papua and Aceh. From Sydney, our correspondent Guy Deegan has more.
It's only a small force of about 5,000 personnel, but across the archipelago, Kopassus is known for its dark past of human rights abuses. Speaking on Australian radio, military analyst Aldo Borgiou says even within Indonesia, Kopassus is viewed with suspicion and there have been a number of attempts to reform it.
We are dealing with a very shady organisation, and in many respects in the past, Kopassus has been more part of the problem than part of the solution.
Australia broke off military training with Indonesian forces in the lead-up to East Timor's vote for independence in 1999, when the Indonesian military was implicated in human rights abuses. So is Australia putting that history aside for regional peace of mind? Just earlier this year, several Kopassus members were found guilty of murdering West Papuan independence leader Dayus Eluai. Journalist and author John Martinkus.
What we'll basically be doing will be training a military force that is used against its own population and has a very long history of murders, human rights abuses, politically motivated kidnappings, that kind of thing.
Martinkus covered East Timor's path to independence and has recently returned to Australia from Aceh. He argues that since the September 11th attacks, the Indonesian military has gone out of its way to reinvent itself as a counter-terrorism force.
All we'll be doing is making it a more professional force to carry out its task, which is more or less state terrorism inside Indonesia.
Is it quite possible that Australian forces could be undertaking military operations with the officers and troops perhaps responsible for massacres and human rights abuses in East Timor and other provinces?
It is. Not just likely, but probably 100% certain that if Australia is training Kopassus, we will be dealing with people who, in any sense of the word, could be viewed as war criminals.
The backdrop to Australia's proposal for joint counter-terrorism training with the Indonesian military is, of course, the Bali bombing trials. But the proposal also comes at a time when the United States is deciding if it will release funds to train Indonesian military officers under the International Military Education and Training Program. Someone campaigning hard to block those funds to seek justice from Indonesia is Patsy Spear, one of the 8 survivors of the ambush near the Freeport mine in West Papua last year, an ambush in which the Indonesian military has been implicated.
I was shot in my vehicle. I was shot at the very beginning, and I was down on the floor of my vehicle for the 45 minutes that the ambush lasted.
Do you see the blocking of funds from the U.S. government to train Indonesian military officers in the U.S. as critical to obtaining and using that as leverage for greater cooperation with this investigation?
It's the only thing I can think of to do. My husband was murdered. 8 of us were wounded. Some are disabled for the rest of their lives. Ted was murdered. Bong Bong was murdered. It's the only thing that I can think of to do to put pressure on my government, to put pressure on the Indonesian government. I don't know who carried out the ambush and why it was done, and that's why we have to have the FBI in to do it, because the Indonesian police and the Indonesian military are unable to do it.
The Australian Department of Defence has not indicated when joint training with the Indonesian military will resume or the exact nature of joint training exercises. In Sydney, Australia, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Guy Deegan.
The conflicts between the US and Venezuela and within Venezuela between the government and the opposition are heating up once again. One reason is a possible recall referendum against Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez. In a little under 2 weeks from now, on August 19, the opposition may officially begin to collect signatures in favour of a recall referendum against the president, who's been a thorn in the side of both the Bush administration and of Venezuela's old governing elite. Carol Delgado and Greg Wilpert have more from Caracas.
Yesterday, Venezuela's Supreme Court ruled that it would appoint the country's National Electoral Council if the National Assembly does not do so itself within 10 days. This ruling has become a central issue in Venezuela because the Electoral Council is necessary for holding a recall referendum that the opposition, which consists of the media, the middle and the upper classes, and the country's former governing parties, are trying to organize against President Chavez. Until now, the legislature has been deadlocked and unable to name the Electoral Council. Last week, the president and other government officials predicted that there would be no recall referendum. In response, the U.S. State Department's spokesman, Richard Boucher, said,
"Reports in the Venezuelan media say that President Chavez said that a recall referendum is unlikely this year. We would note that the Venezuelan Constitution dictates that the decision to have a referendum lies with the courts, the National Electoral Council, and the people of Venezuela, rather than with the executive branch of the government. So these things have been decided. There are commitments that have been made. We expect them to go ahead."
In response to the State Department's comments, Chavez, in a speech a few days ago at a major demonstration commemorating his second electoral victory as president 3 years ago, denounced what he considers to be the U.S. government's meddling in internal Venezuelan affairs.
"I don't give any importance to what the spokesperson of the U.S. State Department has to say. Here, there is a constitution. Here, there is a country. Here is a republic which must be respected and which has dignity. The U.S. should understand one day that the peoples of the world deserve respect. They should rather concern themselves with their own problems. They should concern themselves with the problems they have caused in the Middle East, the problem of Iraq and of its people that are being mistreated."
During the speech, Chavez also emphasized that he fully supports any referenda against his presidency, as long as those organizing it fulfill all of the constitutional requirements for calling one.
"Hugo Chavez, this humble servant, was the one who proposed to the Constitutional Assembly the inclusion of the recall referendum halfway through elected officials' term in office. I am in agreement and always will be in agreement because it gives the people the possibility of evaluating, halfway through the term, an elected official."
The opposition and the U.S. government, however, claim that Chavez and his supporters are seeking to avoid the referendum, a claim that his supporters vehemently deny. Pimentel, a leader of the pro-Chavez community groups known as the Bolivarian Circles, declares his group's support for the referendum as follows.
We are in agreement that if the opposition manages to collect the signatures certified by the National Electoral Council, without any hesitation, we would participate in the referendum. We will not prevent anything that is legally established within the Constitution. We will go out civically to vote the way we see fit.
In contrast to last year's coup attempt and earlier this year's illegal oil industry strike, it is clear that the campaign to oust Chavez legally has begun only now. Greg Bilpert and Carol Delgado reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
Los Angeles, Seattle, and Cambridge, Massachusetts are some of the cities across the United States trying to extend voting rights in local elections to non-US citizens. FSRN correspondent Ingrid Drake reports from Washington, D.C. on efforts to enfranchise its adult immigrant community.
As campaigns are underway for upcoming elections and fundraisers in Washington, D.C., voting advocates are mobilizing to grant the 50,000 non-US citizens who live in the district the right to vote in local elections. The efforts would mainly affect legal immigrants because D.C. law requires an identification card to register to vote. Mario Castaldo of the Voting Rights for All D.C. Coalition believes the immigrant community deserves the right of political self-determination.
There are members of this community who are residents, non-citizens, that have been already working hard with city councils to come out with legislation, to support legislation, to participate in public hearings, town hall meetings. We're a vibrant part of the social and civic part of the District of Columbia. And now we want to take on the political aspect as well.
There's no federal or constitutional provision that limits non-citizen voting. It is up to the state and local jurisdictions to make the distinction. In fact, Tacoma Park, a nearby Maryland suburb, was the first jurisdiction in the nation to extend voting rights to all who registered in 1992. Maryland does not have a state law that limits voting to U.S. citizens. While cities like Cambridge and Amherst, Massachusetts, have passed similar voting rights measures, they are blocked by state law to implement the change. Jameen Raskin, a constitutional law professor at American University, says that in the early years of the United States, immigrants could vote for president and Congress members, as well as in local elections.
Most of the states gave you the right to vote regardless of citizenship. If you were a white male property owner over the age of 21, that is, what mattered was the race qualification, the gender qualification, in some places the religion qualification, you had to be Christian, and the age qualification. But setting all of that aside, if you owned property, they didn't care whether you had been a naturalized U.S. citizen or not. It became controversial in the 1840s and 50s, before the Civil War. Why? Because the immigrants who were coming over were almost uniformly opposed to slavery.
Affordable housing activist Parisa Neruzzi sees extending voting rights as a way to bring together diverse communities to build political power in the district.
We should have allegiance to our neighbors and our brothers and sisters, and not necessarily to some patriotic idea, because we've been left out of that as a whole. The District of Columbia has been left out of the supposed American democracy. So should we have allegiance to this thing that excludes us, or should we have allegiance to each other and into collectively building the political power to ensure that our children and that our society reflects the social justice that we seek?
Organizers say immigrant communities are more directly impacted by local laws regarding health and child care, public education and housing, because they tend to be low income and starting at the lowest rungs of the employment ladder. If D.C. chooses to enfranchise its non-citizen population, organizers of the campaign say it would likely spark a national debate about the lack of a uniform diversity in the United States. Currently, Congress has the power to overturn D.C. law, while D.C. voters do not have voting representation in Congress. It is for this reason, law professor Raskin advocates for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to vote, which would include people living in the territories, immigrants, convicted felons, and D.C. residents.
Our Constitution, unlike almost every other constitution on earth, does not provide for an affirmative right to vote for the people. South Africa Constitution starts out by saying that all citizens of South Africa have a right to vote at every level of government. We don't have anything like that. The Supreme Court has said, as recently as Bush versus Gore, there is no constitutional right to vote. If the Florida legislature wants to throw away the ballots and just appoint electors, it can do it because there's no right of the people to vote for president. It's the Electoral College system. And when D.C. brought the D.C. voting rights case, D.C. got the exact same answer, which was, well, you would have a right to be represented and to vote in the House and the Senate if there were a constitutional right to vote for all American citizens, but there's not.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
As multinational corporations bid on reconstruction contracts in Iraq, today the deadline for bidding on 3 mobile telephone licenses in Iraq was extended until August 21st by the US Central Command. Many neighboring countries to Iraq complain that they've been shut out of potentially lucrative reconstruction contracts in the occupied country. Last Thursday, the US-led coalition in charge of reconstruction floated 3 mobile licenses to offer to, quote, connect Iraqis to the world. Meeting in Amman late last week, regional and international mobile companies called the conditions placed on the bidding process discriminatory, saying they favoured non-Arab companies. Ula Farawati has more from Amman.
The reconstruction of occupied Iraq is underway as bids are floated by the Americans for a range of contracts to establish an Iraqi infrastructure. During the latest bids for cell phone contracts, an American-Iraqi Assistance Center diplomat based in Jordan denied allegations levied by neighboring Arab countries that Arab-based companies are locked out of the reconstruction contracts.
I don't believe the term discriminatory is the right word. I think that they set up a vetting process based on the requirements for the bid that is neutral to parties regardless of geographic location. So I don't think it's discriminatory in the region at all. I mean, you could take a look at American operators and come to the same conclusion that it was, if you want to use the word discriminatory, against them as well.
In the midst of fierce competition to get a share from vast lucrative investment opportunities in Iraq, small Arab companies wishing to bid for the mobile phone licenses in the war-torn country maintain they are consistently shut out of the competition. Batelco, a Bahrain-based telecom company, established a cellular network in Baghdad and was operating for a few days before the U.S. Central Command shut it down. At the bidding, Arab telecommunication companies complained that the terms and conditions for the bids clearly discriminate against them to the benefit of giant Western corporations. They voiced their concerns after the request for proposals was announced in Amman Thursday. Marwan Jum'a is the Jordan representative for Batelco.
There are certain conditions preset in the RFP, in the request for proposal. Any operator or those bidding must have worked or have had operations in minimum 5 locations, and which practically again eliminates almost all players in the region because, with the exception of Orascom, I believe, none have more than 5 locations.
Regional contractors were also upset at the requirement of a $30 million bond as a guarantee that work will go as explained in the bid proposal. Again, Batelco's representative Jum'a said it was a harsh condition, especially that the grace period for the contracts is 2 years.
After 2 years, the game will be open again. Potential for rebidding, potential for new players, potential for change of the rules. So the smaller players with limited resources will find it difficult to bid for such a contract given these conditions. So in a way, we believe it is discriminatory.
According to a study by the Amman-based Arab Advisors Group, mobile phone operators could sell services in Iraq worth about $300 million per year for the next 3 years after the fixed-line network was damaged by the U.S. invasion. Bloomberg quoted Arab Advisors President Jawad Abbasi as saying telecom companies may gain almost 800,000 subscribers by end 2006, and cash-strapped Iraqis are likely to spend upward of $70 a month. The American administration continues to say that Iraqis will help in the reconstruction of their country, but nevertheless, it's a playground for multinational companies to invest and expand. Even as Arab companies vie for contracts in Iraq, U.S.-based corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel are already operating in Iraq and have reported record profits in this quarter. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ola Farawati in Amman, Jordan.
As the media is flooded with reports today of the death of an American civilian in Iraq, he was a contractor employed by Kellogg Brown & Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, the former company of Vice President Dick Cheney, which has major contracts for reconstruction in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The civilian death count of Iraqis is now placed at between 6 and 8,000. This is also today the Arab League foreign ministers ruled out sending troops to help U.S. forces in Iraq. And as Ahmed Al-Rawi reports from Baghdad, it seems Iraqis' faith in the American occupation is also fast waning.
Nowadays, Iraqis are feeling confused about the future of Iraq. The American administration has created a puppet-like committee that claims to represent all Iraqis. Many Iraqis, however, distrust the appointed members since no electoral process brought them to power. The spokesperson of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Adel Abdel Mehdi, expresses his concern about the future of Iraq, pointing out the fact that the American administration should fulfill its promises to the Iraqi people. The future of Iraq is conditioned on the way the American administration acts.
It depends on the way that coalition forces and the administration, the de facto authority of Mr. Bremer, will conduct their acts. We think if they respect fully the resolution of the Security Council and that they will leave the country the first hour of the existence of an Iraqi independent sovereign government. And if they respect the aspirations of Iraqis, we think that we can together, as Americans and Iraqis, overcome this problem peacefully and in a friendly way.
Al-Dawa Party, an Iranian Shiite-backed group, is another division in the Iraqi society that foresees the future as not only conditioned to what Iraqis will do, but also to the plans of the American administration. Qasim al-Sahalni, a spokesperson and a member of the political office of the Al-Dawa Party, says,
"The matter is not confined to what comes out of us, but it depends almost entirely on what the occupying powers will do. They claim that they have come to Iraq to help its people, depending on the needs of the Iraqi individual to get rid of the late dictatorship, installing at the same time an independent democratic system that seeks to establish order, peace and prosperity to the Iraqi people and to the region and to the neighboring countries in particular."
Isra Shakir is the editor-in-chief of the Iraq Al-Yom newspaper that is backed by the American administration. She explains the general situation.
"Now we are without a government or organization or an army. If we were in a better condition, we could have done something big. We need some organization and some finance. We were the ones who called for liberating the countries of the world like Afghanistan and Palestine. How can we become now an occupied country? Definitely no one will accept this."
Adel Rahman Al-Isawi is the editor-in-chief of Al-Aswar newspaper, which is published in the Sunni city of Fallujah. This city is famous for its resistance.
"The American forces and soldiers inside Iraq can easily control the security and order in the country and decrease the level of insecurity, but we see the opposite. I would like to point out a strange hypothesis. If 10,000 American soldiers cannot provide security to the country, while the American administration calls for providing security to these soldiers, how can we control this situation? Don't you see that this matter is naive? Or it is an American attempt to divert the local public opinion inside and outside Iraq? Consequently, the Americans are driving the Iraqi cause into a dark tunnel that will not make us see the light in the near future."
The main topic of concern for Iraqis is the issue of security in the country. Solving it will lead to many positive signs in the Iraqi street. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ahmed Al-Rawi in Baghdad.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.